on this episode of Rebel Spirit Radio.
The double blind, which is the gold standard for scientific experimentation with substances, it doesn't really apply with psychedelics. And that's the problem. Because you can give somebody, one group, antibiotics, and the other group, sugar, and they don't know what's going on. And you can give one group almost anything, and the other group a placebo, and they don't know what's going on. But when you give one group something which affects your psyche, and it affects your psyche dramatically, and the other group gets no effect whatsoever, and everybody in both groups knows they're in a psychedelic experiment, you know, within 15 or 20 minutes or a half hour, everybody knows exactly which group they're in. You can't avoid it.
Welcome to Rebel Spirit Radio, exploring the frontiers of spirituality, consciousness, the esoteric, and humanity's sacred relationship with a living earth. I'm your host, Nick Mather, and in this episode, Dr. Richard Lewis Miller returns to the podcast to discuss his latest book, Psychedelic Medicine at the End of Life. He discusses the ongoing so-called psychedelic renaissance, criticisms of the FDA's denial of MDMA for PTSD treatment, the importance of combining psychedelics with psychotherapy, and how mystical experiences facilitated by psychedelics can reduce the fear of death. Also, please be sure to like and subscribe to this podcast on whatever platform you use to listen to or view podcasts. Your support is truly appreciated. Dr. Richard Lewis Miller has been a clinical psychologist for more than 60 years. He is host of the syndicated talk radio show, Mind, Body, Health, and Politics. He is the founder of the internationally acclaimed Coke Enders Alcohol and Drug Program and creator of the Health Sanctuary at Wilbur Hot Springs. He has been a faculty member at the University of Michigan and Stanford University, and an advisor on the President's Commission on Mental Health. He is the author of several books, including Psychedelic Medicine, Psychedelic Wisdom, and Freeing Sexuality. He joins me today to discuss his latest publication, Psychedelic Medicine at the End of Life. Richard, welcome back to Rebel Spirit Radio.
Thank you for having me today, Nick.
Yeah, well, I'm always happy when people come back, and I love the book and am very excited to kind of dig into it with you. There is this ongoing, what's being referred to as psychedelic renaissance, and psychedelic therapies are being looked at for treating a variety of things. And one of the areas that I've noticed research being published is in psychedelics and how they can help at the end of life, especially to help alleviate anxiety and perhaps some fear. But you kind of take the book in different directions. I mean, you address that, and I want to talk to you about that. But there are some other areas that you get into, which I found quite refreshing. But let's begin with some of the clinical studies that have been published about using psychedelic medicines at the end of life to help alleviate anxieties and fears.
Well, to begin with, Nick, yes, there's a lot of talk around the country about this, quote, psychedelic renaissance. And certainly, after I've been, quote, fighting the fight, unquote, for over 50 years, the fight being the fight to allow basic research, the fight to make some of these medicines legal. Although we're referring to it as a renaissance because the government, in its lack of wisdom, is finally allowing some research. The fact is, all psychedelic-like, and that like, not psychedelic substances, but even psychedelic-like substances, such as marijuana, are still illegal at the federal level. So it's a very interesting thing, Nick, to say, we're having a renaissance, but it's all illegal. I mean, how do you have an illegal renaissance? Would that be like all the painters in a painting renaissance go to jail? I mean, or they're all looking over their shoulder because every time they paint something, they could be criminally prosecuted? Because that's the situation we're in right now, Nick. People who are involved in the marijuana industry, for example, such as my friend Steve D'Angelo, the godfather of marijuana, who started Harborside, the famous place in Oakland, cannot get a bank account.
Right.
Because anybody who is in the marijuana business cannot get a bank account because the banks are all connected to the federal government. So to say we're having a renaissance is a very nice thing, and it sounds pretty, and it's very optimistic, but it's not literally what's going on. What's literally going on is that there are people all over the United States who are doing illegal acts. They're doing illegal acts by guiding people in psychedelic experiences. They're doing illegal acts by congregating around psychedelic experiences. And on a national level, tens of millions of people are doing illegal acts when they're smoking marijuana. Literally tens of millions of people. And this is very concerning to me, because we're living in times where there's a lot of misinformation and lack of trust going on. And it's being added to by the specter of honest people being made into criminals by engaging in activity which in their home state may be legal, but which according to the federal government is illegal. So it's like you sort of look over your shoulder a little bit. You don't look over your shoulder a lot. The local police may not arrest you, but if you're engaging in the marijuana business, the federal government could come in at any time and knock you out of business. So, renaissance, progress, I would be willing to say.
All right.
Progress. And while we're on that theme of the federal government, Nick, I'm very pleased to be here with you today on Rebel Spirit and to have the opportunity to talk about my latest book, Psychedelic Medicine at the End of Life, because it is an important book, if I may say so, in that all of us are going to face the end of life. And many of us are in a very awkward position, Nick, and that is, if we have either religion or we have religion in our background, we're liable to find ourselves very frightened, if not downright anxious, as we come towards the end of life. And the reason is that the people of religion, which are really cults that were successful, you know, a little cult that becomes 20 million people is a religion. A little cult that becomes 240 people is still a cult. And what they figured out hundreds, if not over 1,000 years ago, was that the best way to control people and get them to behave in the way that you want them to is to tell them that there's an afterlife, and that if you behave in the way we want you to behave, in the way we think you should behave, then you're going to go to a beautiful place. And if you're a Christian, the Christian people are sent to heaven. If you're Islamic, you maybe go to some place they have where there are all these virgins waiting for you. If you belong to another religion, They may have people with harps. At one point, I actually read that Skelly and Kellevich and White, which is one of our country's great polling companies, came out with a report that 52% of America believe that when they die, if they make it to heaven, there'll be angels playing harps waiting for them. And so if you have that in your background, there's going to be fear. Now, you might say, why am I afraid if I'm going to heaven? And the reason is, when the religious people gave us heaven, they also gave us hell for those who do not behave in the way we want you to behave. You're going down there. Now, none of us is perfect. We have all sinned, if you will, in our lives in some way. Therefore, any of us who are subject to that religious information might be thinking towards the end, you know, I'm not so sure I'm going to that place with the angels. I may be going down there. And that's enough to scare people, particularly when you're getting real old and you're up there in the age and, you know, your time is coming and you start thinking, I don't know if I want to spend eternity down there, right? Anyway, I'm dramatizing, but you get my point. It scares the bejeebers out of most people because they think they're going to go to the wrong place, and that's scary. So they've got anxiety, they've got depression, they've got a lot of fear, and what we've come to is a realization that there's a huge potential in these psychedelic medicines to ease these existential emotional disturbances. So, you know, that's sort of the crux of the book. It's about that. But since you're hesitating there for a second and giving me a lot of space, which you do, and I appreciate, Nick, it's very, very good of you, I want to interject, and you can cut me off here if you want, because you're the boss. It feels a little odd for me nowadays to be talking about my book or even to be talking about almost anything else other than the upcoming election. Because I'm 85 years old, Nick. So I've gone through at least 70 years of elections that I was, you know, aware of, if not longer. Actually longer, because I was aware in high school as well. And we have never had anything in my lifetime that comes close to what we're facing in this election. Not even close. Now, all my life, I haven't been a Democrat or a Republican. I've been what's called an independent or an independent thinker. I look at the people who are running, what their character is like, and I look at what they stand for. And in some ways, I've gravitated towards the what the Democrats were putting forth, some ways towards what the Republicans were putting forth, although they switch all the time in terms of what they stand for. But basically, what I believe, Nick, is that both parties are corrupt, and both parties are having a party in Washington, and we, the people, are paying for it. That's what I believe. I believe we're paying for their party. And why do I believe that? I believe that because money corrupts even the best of people. And also, politicians are willing to use blackmail and extortion to get other politicians to vote their way. So when you put together money, blackmail, and extortion, I do not expect a great deal of honesty from either party. There's too much of that, particularly when we passed a law that allows corporations to be considered people, and they can make these gigantic donations, and so can these things called PACs make these giant. So we have money is influencing our politics. And so I have misgivings about our political system. I very much am a patriot. I've studied the American Revolution in detail. I love our American Revolution. I love what it stands for. I love the fact that we stopped being subjects to some guy called a king and we became citizens. I love that with every iota of my body. The idea of being a subject to one person called a king is odious to me. It's just repugnant. And the fact that these little group of people, this small group, Washington and Jefferson and Franklin and Adams and Madison got together, such a small number, only 50 some odd people signed the Declaration of Independence. There were 3 million in the United States at the time. It's marvelous that we threw away those chains and became the third country in all of history to be a democracy and a republic. The Greeks, Athens, they had a semblance of a democracy, but remember, women weren't part of it, and slaves weren't part of it, and the Greeks had tons of slaves. And then the Roman for a while had a democracy and a republic until Julius Caesar, of course, crossed the Rubicon and created an empire. But before that, there was a republic. But again, even in Rome, which was a nice experiment, women did not have the right to vote, and one third of the population was slaves. So we became our national revolution, and we threw that off. And I'm very proud of that. So when you hear me saying our government's corrupt, please don't hear me saying that I'm not proud of who we are. I'm not proud of who we stand for, because I am. And we may still be one of the best, if not the best, systems in the world. But we have a lot of work to do, Nick. A lot of work to do to get rid of this corruption. And why I'm concerned about this election is that this man Trump is a threat to democracy, and he's a threat to republic. All of us know that. All of any thinking person can tell that this man is out to be a man for himself. He's out to be a dictator. He does not care about people or the country. He cares about himself and his family. And I'm very concerned about that. And that's really what's on my radar screen. And compared to that, you know, my book is just like a grain of sand on the beach, but I'll still talk about the grain of sand with you today. I'll talk about the grain of sand, but I needed to get that in, Nick, because it's burning inside of me.
Yeah.
Every day I look at the news and I see how tight it is. The election is so tight and I tremble. My God, what am I going to do? What is our country going to do if this man possibly gets elected? What happens to us? What happens to the American dream? What happens to that beacon of light, the Statue of Liberty? What happens to the statue that I grew up with as a kid in New York? So proud to have the Statue of Liberty, where people came from all over the world because they want to be part of America. And those of us in the social sciences, we know the animals come to where the best food is. Animals are coming to the United States because it's the best place to live. So with that rant, let me take a break and hear you, Nick.
Yeah, well, just in response to that, I just wanted to add that I have with two friends, we do a monthly live stream, Cocktail Apocalypse, Happy Hour at the End of the World. And next week, we're recording the next live stream, and it's Election 2024, American Apocalypse. So we'll be addressing some of these ideas. We're still kind of hashing things out, but definitely we're going to be looking at some of the apocalyptic rhetoric that is coming from specifically Donald Trump, in the sense of painting this picture of the United States as like a hellscape and a wasteland. And also we'll probably talk about ideas of hope in apocalyptic narratives, but also we'll probably even look at some of these ideas that have gone around from a religious perspective, that one of the candidates seems an awful, very anti-Christian in a sense, even though he claims to represent Christian thought. But the other thing I'll say, other than my plug there, is I did my doctoral dissertation on kind of looking at the Republican form of government in the United States. And I went back to the Greeks and to the Romans and whatnot. And the focus was trying to identify, because I knew that republics, going all the way back to Plato and Aristotle, one of the main ideas was that for a republic to survive, the citizens and the politicians had to be people of virtue. And what I was trying to do was look at the history of the American political and religious culture to see if I could identify what might be core American virtues that I could then extend to environmental virtues. I was trying to beat the Republican Party at their own game. But then what happened is they just completely abandoned any idea of virtue. And that's typically what I will say in regards to Trump is, you know, I want to give him a benefit of a doubt in some ways that he's not just awful, completely awful, but I have yet to be able to identify a single virtue that that man has. And we've been told over and over and over, and we have history that tells us that men of vice will destroy the republic.
Yes.
You know,
yes.
So, yeah.
I want to hear a little bit more, may I, about your live stream. Where is it? What can you tell me about it? How can I listen to it?
Sure. It's if you go to the Rebel Spirit, the Rebel Spirit Radio page on YouTube. Usually I think on YouTube, there's a menu. When you go to that page, there should be a tab for live streams, and just click on that and that'll take you to scheduled live streams. Right now there's one, like I said, we do this typically the second Saturday of the month. We had to postpone last month, but if you click on that, you'll see the link and it's at noon Mountain Time. So that'd be 11 a.m. Yeah, your time. Yeah.
So if I understand you, Nick, what you're saying is you will be broadcasting live.
Yes.
And we will be able to watch you live.
Yes. Yes.
And then, of course, it's archived. So if we miss it, we can then watch it later.
Yes, that is correct.
And this is on YouTube?
Yes. And hopefully, I think that I'm still kind of figuring out a lot of the live streaming tech issues, but it should also be on Facebook and Instagram as well, I think.
Oh, live or archived?
Live, yeah.
So it'll be live on YouTube, live on Instagram, and live on Facebook all at the same time.
If I have the technology working, yes.
Oh, that's terrific, Nick. That's really great.
Yeah, we don't have too much of an audience at the moment. We're kind of building it up, but it's two friends of mine that I know from graduate school. And so we do this and we look at apocalyptic themes every month. We thought it was very appropriate to do election 2024. So,
well, I'll talk to my, send me some information with the exact time and date, Nick.
Okay. And I can send you the link too.
Yeah, because I'll talk to my producer, Charlie. You've talked to Charlie. Maybe I'd be allowed to give you a plug because, on Instagram, I've got 11 million viewers and I'm right short of 150,000 followers.
Wow.
So if I'm allowed to put a plug in for you, I'll do that.
Okay. Wonderful. I would appreciate that. Thank you very much.
Of course.
Yeah. So let's get back to the book.
Yeah.
Well, one thing, and this actually isn't in the book, but I did want to ask you about, because in the book, you had mentioned that it was very likely that MDMA was going to be legalized for use in, especially in PTSD treatments. But since writing, the FDA has denied the use of this. And I was actually trying to refresh my brain as to what the foundation of their denial was. I know it was just limitations in the clinical trials, but I don't remember exactly what that was.
Well, yeah, I can tell you, Nick, there were several things that they focused on.
Mm.
And some of them were ridiculous. For example, they focused on the fact that there was a sexual transgression.
Mm.
Now, I'm not saying a sexual transgression was ridiculous. What I am saying is you don't deny a medicine that has the potential to help maybe millions of people because one practitioner committed an illegal act. No question it was an illegal act, and no question he should be taken to task, if not prosecuted, for it. That's not a question. But to use that as a reason to deny a medicine, that's not science to me. Right. That's some kind of morality play, yeah, or judgment. Mm. Now, the one argument that they had that did make sense to me, and so I called Rick Doblin on the phone to discuss it with him. They said that 40% of the subjects were not naive subjects.
Mm.
They had experienced MDMA in the past.
Mm.
So what that meant is it sort of undermines the double blind.
Mm.
Because in the double blind, you take 100 people, you divide them in half, 50-50, 50 of them get the medicine, 50 of them get the placebo. Nobody knows who's getting what, including the experimenters. But of course, if 40% of those people, namely 40 out of 100 or 20 in each side, have already had MDMA, well, then of course, you could say they know what's going on in advance. However, Nick, the double blind, which is the gold standard for scientific experimentation with substances, it doesn't really apply with psychedelics. And that's the problem. Because you can give somebody, one group, antibiotics, and the other group, sugar, and they don't know what's going on. And you can give one group almost anything, and the other group a placebo, and they don't know what's going on. But when you give one group something which affects your psyche, and it affects your psyche dramatically, and the other group gets no effect whatsoever, and everybody in both groups knows they're in a psychedelic experiment, you know, within 15 or 20 minutes or a half hour, everybody knows exactly which group they're in. You can't avoid it. That just is a intrinsic aspect of doing research in psychedelics. So to disqualify for that reason, again, was suspect. And so I called Rick Doblin on the phone. And by the way, for those of you listening who don't know who Rick Doblin is, you know, I don't know. Rick Doblin is the founder of MAPS, the Multidisciplinary Association for Psychedelic Studies. He is the point man for legalizing MDMA ever since I met him in 1985. So that's 39 years ago. Rick has been leading the charge to legalize this medicine because he became a believer in it back in the 80s as having huge therapeutic potential. When I met him in 1985 at the Esalen Institute, I had already experienced MDMA in my therapist's office because it was still legal. And I was a clinical psychologist when my therapist administered it to me. And I can tell you, and not only was I already a clinical psychologist, I was already, you know, in my 40s. I was a mature clinical psychologist. I took this material, MDMA, one time, the first time. And by the end of the therapy session, I knew that we had something here that was one step this side of miraculous for couples therapy. Why is that? Because I recognized that what this medicine did to me, it opened up my heart. It made me much more vulnerable, much more able to listen to what was going on around me. It dropped my defenses so that when my therapist in the session said something to me, instead of getting defensive or wanting to somehow come back or push back or whatever, I listened, I took it in, I considered it, and I was also more empathetic to what my therapist was feeling at the time. And I do retrospect on the session, and I'm saying, he gave me a medicine that lowered my defenses, increased my empathy, and opened myself up in the heart. This is one hell of a medicine. I can't wait to use this with a married couple who are having couples problems. It'll be so helpful, right? So that was 39 years ago. So I call, that's a way of just introducing Rick to your to our listeners. So I called Rick on the phone a couple of weeks ago, or whatever it was, months ago now, I guess time goes by so fast, and said, you know, about this, the FDA, and these 40 people, 40% of the subjects were not naive. And Rick says, we ran that by the FDA before we did the study, and they approved it. They knew that 40% of the subjects were not naive. So that's what I can report. It looks to me like a political hatchet job. And, you know, it just does. Yeah. And it set us back. It's very disappointing. And the most disappointing part of it, Nick, is that these politically motivated politicians are denying human beings a medicine that is different from any medicine they've ever taken in their entire lives. And to deny people a medicine of this magnitude is simply reprehensible.
Yeah,
that's what I have to say about it.
Yeah, I would agree. I was rather shocked when the FDA rejected the approval of it. And I often, you know, also immediately began wondering about money from big pharmacy.
Well, of course.
Yeah,
of course, because big pharma has not been able to come up with anything for post-traumatic stress disorder. And big pharma certainly doesn't have anything to offer for couples therapy. And so here we have a medicine that can do that. And it's threatening. And the other thing about this medicine is it's not a medicine that you take every single day, like the pharmacies like to sell and manufacture, that, like the SSRIs that you have to take every day for the rest of your life. It's something you take once in a while.
Right.
So the profit is markedly less, right?
Yeah.
That's what we're dealing with.
Yeah. That brings up a question for me in the sense of, and this is slightly off topic, but not entirely. My understanding is that with treating ailments like depression, for example, the statistics are that the drugs that the, and I'm going to say drugs here, and I always like to distinguish between medicine and drugs, but I'm specifically saying drugs here. The SSIs, is that what they are? That
SSRIs.
Yeah, SSRIs, thank you. That they're only about 50% effective or so, and they're a little bit more effective with the introduction of therapy. And it seems to me that the, kind of losing my train of thought here, I had this question.
Well, you're on the right track. Let me help you.
Yeah.
You're on the right track because, first of all, you gave them a little bit too much credit. The SSRIs, by the way, that for our listeners, that stands for selective serotonin reuptake inhibitors. And what that means is these medicines stop a neurotransmitter from being transmitted. And when it stops the neurotransmitter from being transmitted, the neurotransmitter builds up. And the theory is when you build up serotonin, because the uptake is being inhibited, you decrease depression. More serotonin, less depression. If you read Robert Whittaker's book, and by the way, Nick, I highly recommend you interview Robert Whittaker. He wrote a fantastic book called Anatomy of an Epidemic. He is a high-level international journalist and a good researcher. And what he found when he researched the SSRIs in depth is about one-third of the people who take them benefit. One-third get no result whatsoever, and one-third get worse, significantly worse. And here is why, Nick, and this is what's so important for your listeners to know. The companies that produce these SSRIs are going on a belief system that people who have emotional and mental disorders have disordered brain chemistry. And people who are depressed, they have brain chemistry which is out of balance. And so the big pharma believe that the medicines they're making put the neurotransmitters in our bodies back in balance. The problem with their theory is, as Whittaker points out in Anatomy of an Epidemic, emotional illnesses do not bring out of balance in our neurotransmitters. It's not what happens. So what happens then, in effect, Nick, is that you're taking these medicines, SSRIs, applying them to a neurotransmitter system that's already in balance, and you're creating a lack of balance by putting in the medicine. And that's why a third of the people get worse.
Okay. Yeah, that makes a lot of sense to me, because one of the things that I've always kind of struggled with is that and I guess it's this reductionist idea. And you write that psychedelics really challenge and defy reductionist explanations. But I've always been like, okay, because I've had periods of depression, and some of the responses are, well, you know, you've got the brain chemicals are out of whack, but there's never any testing for that. And I could have legitimate reasons that I'm depressed, like, you know, having lost a loved one or come out of a long-term relationship. And so I've always maintained that there's a correlation perhaps with the serotonin and whatnot, but I can't say that what's going on in the brain is causing the depression. So that means to me that there has to be a different way of tackling the depression.
Yes. Actually, in scientific terms, the most effective treatment that we have for depression turns out to be not a psychological treatment. And so it hasn't gained favor, and it also has an inherent flaw. The most effective treatment for depression is aerobic exercise. But aerobic exercise has an inherent flaw, which is you have to do it.
Yeah.
You can't just eat it.
Right.
You can't take an aerobic exercise pill and get your body exercised. You have to go out and actually exercise. So we have an interesting kind of enigma here, Nick. You have the number one treatment for depression, which doesn't cost anything other than a pair of sneakers.
Yeah.
It costs nothing. And people could get wonderfully cured. But the question is, how do you get a person who's depressed to go out and exercise when they don't even want to get up out of their chair?
Right.
They don't even want to get out of bed. Right. Because depression is a depression. Like it push it. That's why we use the word.
Right.
It weighs us down and we feel heavy and we feel without motivation and we feel like a beautiful day looks gray. So it's a very interesting thing. And I've had to face that as a clinician for 64 years. How do I take the number one treatment that has no negative side effects, except wearing out your sneakers, and has no negative side effects, doesn't cost anything, almost everybody can do it. How do you get a depressed person to do that? That's a very interesting challenge. And that challenge is what makes people open to taking a pill in hope that the pill will do the job. But, you know, there's no such a thing as a pill for an attitude that's negative. A pill doesn't change your attitude. A pill can change your physiology. It can give you more energy. That's true. But it doesn't change your mindset. You know, it's just like for 10 years, Nick, I specialized in chemical dependence. You mentioned in the introduction I started the Coke Ender's Alcohol and Drug Program. You know, when a person stops taking cocaine, they don't stop lying. They don't stop cheating on their wives. They don't stop doing all the things that are part of the cocaine lifestyle. When alcoholics stop drinking, they still keep acting like alcoholics because the behavior that goes with the symptom of the coke, the heroin, the alcohol, the gambling, the overeating, the lifestyle that goes with the symptom continues to march forward. So even if there is a pill to stop the particular symptom, like there is a pill you can take, and if you drink alcohol, it makes you throw up. But it's not very popular. But even if you can stop the symptom, you still have to address all the behavioral manifestations. You still have to learn how to tell the truth if you're a liar. You still have to learn how to be honest if you become a thief, right? And that's the issue with depression as well. And so it's a very challenging, that's a very challenging topic. Now, the interesting aspect is psychedelics do work on the attitude. They're not working on just on the physiology. Psychedelics work on our actual mental set and our attitude. Psychedelics work on how we see the world. Psychedelics give us an opportunity to witness ourselves. And being able to witness ourselves, what we call self-awareness, that's probably one of the most powerful tools that human beings have for correcting their own behavior, isn't it? Yeah. The ability to see ourselves as we're doing what we're doing so that we can make corrections. And if you're listening to this and wondering what I mean, imagine watching a car drive down the street and you're watching it from about 15 feet above and you have a little tool and you can make corrections in the driving of the car with this tool. So you're looking down and watching it and making corrections. And imagine if you could do the same thing for yourself while you're talking, while you're behaving, while you're going through the world. You're watching yourself and making the corrections so that you become the person that you want to be. You get to sculpt your own person. What a marvelous thing that would be.
Yeah. Yeah. And it brings to mind a couple of things. And I have this down as something I wanted to talk to you about, because from a philosophical perspective, this is the importance of living an examined life. And you have an entire chapter devoted to living fully. And one of the things that I've often said is that I have this sense that it's not necessarily death that people fear, but living their lives is a little bit more fearful to them. And, you know, speak of our political system and our government, it seems as if these choices of how to live our lives and to live freely, I mean, really freely, are not open to everybody. And I think it's this sense of not having options that traps people in, and that is one of the primary causes of depressions and anxieties in our culture as well.
Nick, say some more about what you mean now about that living fully is what's fearful. I'd like to hear a little bit more on that.
Yeah, it's thank you for putting me on the spot, but it's perfect. You know, one of my intellectual role models, I suppose, is Henry David Thoreau. And I've been thinking a lot lately, you know, because I also come from a background of environmental ethics and religion and ecology. And Thoreau is often credited with focused on his statement, not in Walden, but in a different essay, that in wildness is the preservation of the world. And a lot of people take that and they translate it to wilderness. And I don't think that that's what he meant. So if you look at Walden and when he talks about why he's going into the woods, you know, he's not far from the city. He's like a 15-20 minute walk. He would go and have dinner with the Emersons every Sunday. You know, he wasn't isolated, but he says that he went there to live deliberately. And the way I look at it is it was a little bit less of being out in nature and a little bit more of tapping into actual freedom. And he criticizes the system of, you know, he also says, you know, the mass of men lead lives of quiet desperation. And I think that still is true, that the mass of people lead these lives of quiet desperation because we feel as if we are caught in this system that doesn't allow us to, even though we have this focus on life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness, we're very much prevented from those actual pursuits.
So if I understand you, what you're saying is believing that the lack of options, the narrowness that people are funneled into is what's constricting them. And the constriction is a form of depression because their lives are so narrow.
Yes, in large part, yes. And yeah.
Well, you know, Nick, that's an interesting theory you have there, because it ties in with the fact that 72% of the United States right now are living paycheck to paycheck. Mm-hmm. And if you're living paycheck to paycheck, and you know that if your refrigerator breaks, you don't have the money for a new refrigerator for your kids, that's taking away your options.
Yeah.
And that can cause depression, mm-hmm. and it can cause terrible feelings. And that's what you're talking about, living that constricted life. And at the basis of that, Nick, is our economic structure, isn't it?
Yeah.
Because capitalism is a king of the hill game. Capitalism is a game where a few people at the top take everything, and most everybody else is left with very little or nothing. And mm-hmm. and we have built our country on a capitalistic system. And so now it's come to roost. 72% of the country living paycheck to paycheck is a very frightening phenomenon.
Yeah. No, I'm there. I live in my friend's basement now because the entire system, this is totally off topic, but the entire system is a system of exploitation. You know, I'm a college professor and I'm living in a friend's basement because 70% of college professors now are adjuncts with no benefits, no job security, nothing.
Wow. What city do you live in, Nick? Where are you?
I'm in Denver now. I used to be in Pasadena, but because of class cuts, I could no longer support myself. So I left California. So, and I'm very grateful for my friend. You know, I've got an awesome recording space here.
Yeah.
You know, and I love being back in Denver. My soul lives in the Rockies, I think. But I think that the system itself is a large contributor to our mental health. And I see a lot of people end up numbing themselves. And I see that as one of the main features of addictions. You know, they're just trying to numb it, and they're already numb to their lives in a way because we can't live them fully because the system won't allow us to.
Yes. And I agree with you that there's a lot of numbing going on.
Yeah.
The other major way, Nick, that people are numbing themselves is by eating large amounts of food,
mm-hmm.
taking huge amounts of material into their bodies as a way of numbing out their emotions.
Yeah.
And so we have another 72% number, 72% living paycheck to paycheck, 72% overweight or obese, 72%, the highest in all of recorded history. One out of every three children born today will be diabetic at this rate. It's unsustainable. It's not something that's talked about because there's fat shaming and fat blaming. And so nobody really knows how to talk about it. But it is the most critical epidemic going on in the United States today.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, no, I agree. I have one of my best friends has struggled with her weight for all of her adult life. And I've also seen that and one of the things that she's struggled with is that it's so cultural in terms of connecting with others. You know, let's connect and go out and have pizza. And that was one of her frustrations, was every time people wanted to go out, they wanted to go out to places that served really horrible food.
Yeah.
And there weren't that many healthy food options available. So the system, we got to work the system. Speaking of the system, I'm trying to get back here. One of the things that I wanted to ask you about was especially psychedelics at the end of life and psychedelics in terms of treating anxiety. And I was making a connection. I had a guest on a while back, Alan Pierce, and he's a former BBC correspondent, and he and his wife, Beverly, wrote a book, Coma and Near-Death Experience, which is an absolutely fascinating book, a little bit mistitled because the focus isn't so much on near-death experience. The focus is on medical practices that are unnecessary. So, for example, the intubation is largely unnecessary. And putting people into comas while they have been intubated is actually even less necessary. But they also mentioned some of the drugs that are given. And this one hit home for me because my mother, when she was dying of cancer, and we didn't know that she was dying so much, we thought there may still be hope, but she had all this anxiety. So they started giving her Atrovent, which is a common anxiety medication that hospitals give.
And Ativan?
And one of the side effects of that is delirium. So what happened is my mother developed what they said was terminal delirium and said, it's time to move her into a hospice. And it's like, if I had known that the drug itself could have caused the delirium, maybe she would have had a fighting chance. But you know, that's just my personal experience with it. But it seems to me that if we shift from to treat the anxieties to this model of psychedelics, be it psilocybin or MDMA or LSD and some therapy, that could actually save some lives and allow people not to succumb to a system that is sometimes pushing them towards their death.
You made a very important point there, Nick, which I want to underline. When you said, you mentioned the psychedelics and therapy, it's very important for the public to hear at a very deep level that the psychedelic medicines are not treatments in and of themselves. This is very important because there are a lot of medicines which are treatments in and of themselves. For example, if you have an infection and you take an antibiotic, the antibiotic is the treatment. It does the entire job. If you have a headache and you take aspirin, the aspirin is the treatment. And I could go on naming others, right? You have an infection on your skin, you put a topical antibiotic on it, that is the treatment. But with psychedelics, these are very unusual medicines, and you cannot relate to them the way you do everything else in your life. They really are that different. These medicines are not treatments. These medicines facilitate treatment. And that is the key word. These medicines are used in conjunction with psychotherapy. So what they do is they facilitate the therapy. When I say that psychedelic medicine at the end of life, I'm not talking about people going around at the end of life popping psychedelic medicines into their mouths. What I'm talking about is them using psychedelic medicine at the end of the life at their lives in conjunction with talk therapy, and the combination of the medicine and the talk therapy is what eliminates the anxiety and the depression and the fears and all the uncomfortable emotions. But the therapy is an essential aspect of it. And this is one of the areas, Nick, that the FDA is having a lot of trouble, because the FDA does not know how to measure or account for a medicine that requires a therapist to be in on the job while the medicine is doing what it's doing. The FDA is the Food and Drug Administration. It's not the Food, Drug, and Psychotherapy Administration. So they've got an X factor to deal with, and it's something that we will have to deal with.
Yeah.
Again, for the public to know, psychedelic medicines facilitate treatment. They are not treatment in and of themselves.
Yeah, and I think something else that you pointed out in the book is also very important, and I was guilty of thinking like this when it came to ayahuasca, but this is not just a one and done sort of situation that you can't take, you know, the psilocybin or whatever psychedelic and that's going to fix everything, that it may take several different, I want to say ceremonies, but that's the ayahuasca term, but
sessions,
yes, to actually help alleviate some of the fears and anxieties that are involved.
Oh, I would say absolutely it's going to take several, no question, depending on the depth of your of the issue.
Yeah.
And the psychedelic medicine that's being used the most with the end-of-life studies is psilocybin. And psilocybin is a 4 to 6 hour experience, and it can be repeated. There's no downside of doing sequential psilocybin sessions. Psilocybin-assisted psychotherapy sessions, there's no downside of that whatsoever. So we can look forward, hopefully, to a lot more of it. But as I said in the beginning of the program, all of these medicines are still illegal at the federal level. So if you want psychedelic medicine-assisted psychotherapy to deal with end-of-life transitions, you have to go to Denver, Colorado, where Nick lives.
Yes.
Oakland, California, or the state of Oregon. And those three areas, and there are some other cities that I'm not mentioning because I don't can't think of the names right now, that also. So you have to go to a place where it's locally legal. And then, of course, you're still doing something that's federally illegal, but the federal government has not been prosecuting practitioners. So that's the good news. We just know that they could at any moment. But Colorado and Oregon are leading the way with regard to legal psychedelic-assisted psychotherapy.
Yeah, and it's still a work in progress here. I know that.
It's a work in progress. That is right.
Yeah. And I think it's also important, and I was curious, because, you know, we've talked about therapists with psychedelics, but what about other people? I think that a certification is important, but that certification, couldn't that be open to other people? I'm thinking like spiritual leaders. I think in the book you mentioned like psychedelic coaches, something like that. What would you envision as the most effective way for people to get a legitimate guide? Assuming that maybe, you know, we can even start from a point that, you know, if it were legal everywhere, what would be the certification and who could receive the certification?
Well, that's a great question, Nick, and it's a very complicated question.
Okay.
Because the issue that we're dealing with at the experimental level right now with regard to psychedelic medicine is that the treatment is a one-on-one treatment, meaning one therapist for one patient. And when you have a medicine that lasts for 4 to 6 hours, you're talking about a lot of money. You have 6 hours of a therapist time, and if they charge, let's say, $200 an hour, you're talking about $1,200 for a day's treatment. That's not going to work for the majority of the United States. That's a treatment for the elite, for the people at the top. So what are we putting in all this time and energy for to create a medicine for the wealthy? That's not where my life has gone. So where I see this headed, Nick, is that it's going to have to be group therapy, which is something that I've specialized in myself. And group therapy is a skill. And not all professional therapists know how to do group therapy. Certainly guides and coaches don't necessarily know how to do group therapy. So you have a complicated situation where you both have to learn the skill of doing psychedelic-assisted treatment in a group setting. So that's one skill. And then you also need the professional skill of dealing with psychological issues that come up, which in many cases, only professionally trained therapists know how to deal with. I think, you know, your average guide or coach can handle a lot of ordinary situations, but they're not going to be able to handle many situations that are more extreme than that. So there's going to have to be a lot of thought given to how we're going to put this all together. Are we going to have guides and coaches who are going to work, but maybe they're going to be a phone call away from a therapist who can come in on a Zoom and give them the guidance they need? Or are they going to have a way that somebody can drive over quickly and jump into the group and help? So we have some complications that we have to deal with. But I would say the number one complication, and it's just a complication, it's nothing that can't be dealt with, is the move from individual treatment to group treatment.
Yeah.
Because that will make it financially possible for large numbers of people to participate. And I, for one, am not interested in fostering treatment that's only for the upper class.
Right.
That's not what our country is about for me.
Yeah. Yeah. And when I was reading this in your book, what came to mind was the ceremonies I've sat in with ayahuasca, there's usually about 20 participants. So it's not just you and a shaman and you alone in a room, but you are with a group, and then there would be the group integration. And they actually had certified educated counselors there to help guide and ongoing integration as well. They have like weekly Zoom calls with the counselor if you should want, if anything's coming up and things like that. And that seems like it's a good model of the group therapy.
Nick, what the country is learning is what you mentioned earlier in our interview. This is not a one-shot deal.
Yeah.
There was a time when a psychedelic, what you called ceremony or a psychedelic experience, consisted of a Friday afternoon meeting, a Saturday ceremony, a Sunday morning integration, and that was it.
Yeah.
And what everybody is realizing now is the introduction time needs to be lengthier, but the follow-up needs to be much lengthier.
Yeah.
Because if you're really talking about psychedelic-assisted psychotherapy, psychotherapy doesn't take place in a weekend. Psychotherapy is something that goes on for months, and in some cases, for years. So just because you added a psychedelic doesn't mean that suddenly you drop all of that. There is still therapy to be done. And I like what you said about after your ayahuasca experience, there were follow-up sessions for you to talk to somebody. And so that if you got into some kind of psychic difficulty, they could help you. But more importantly, you could mine the richness of the ceremony that you undertook.
Yeah.
Because from my perspective, the day you take the psychedelic is the day you go into your inner mine of gold. And the days and weeks and months and years that follow are the days that you polish up those gemstones that you took out of that mine during that one day. And the more days that you do the psychedelics, the more you're going into your personal minefield, the more nuggets you have to polish up in the time ahead. And that's how the process goes. Mining and polishing. Mining and polishing.
I like that. I like that.
Thank you.
If you don't mind, I have one last question here. And that was, I want to take a step back with, you know, we've been talking about anxiety and fear and how that's treated, not just with psychedelics, but at the end of life, you had mentioned previously how so many people fear going to hell. And I am curious if and how psychedelics can help alleviate that fear.
Well, there are two things that come to mind immediately. One is on the philosophical level, and one is on the practical level. On the philosophical level, the person needs to consider whether there really is such a place as hell that they're going to be going to. On the practical level, just as I said that the best treatment we have for depression is aerobic exercise. Sounds funny, doesn't it? Depression, a psychological condition, and you treat it by running, by exercising. And yet the answer is yes. And there is research to back that up. The research was done by Duke University. The research was also done by Consumer Reports. Research followed by research, comparing aerobic exercise to various medicines, and the aerobics came in first. I'm saying this because you're bringing up transitioning to death anxiety, and once again, the simplest, cheapest, most effective treatment for anxiety turns out to be a physiological exercise called diaphragmatic or abdominal breathing. Diaphragmatic or abdominal breathing is faster than a speeding Valium. It is the most effective way of treating anxiety that is known to humankind. And yet, because it's so simple, because it's so easy, because it can be done anywhere, it is suspect. People say, that's impossible. How could that be? That's not a medicine. What are you talking about? And come up with all kinds of reasons not to give it a try. But I'm here to tell you, after 64 years of practicing clinical psychology, diaphragmatic breathing is the number one treatment for anxiety.
Yeah.
That's what I can share. And it don't cost nothing.
Yeah. Well, and I guess one of the things I was curious about and is with that sort of fear of hell was, especially with psilocybin, that frequently people have sort of mystical experiences. And I was thinking that perhaps that shifts their thought process in regards to what may be awaiting them, that maybe it is expanding their spirituality to some extent. And that, because you noted at one point in the book that the people who rated experiences as very mystical showed the greatest improvements in attitudes, mood, and behavior. And so I was just kind of curious if there was a connection with that and helping alleviate fear of going to hell.
When we feel like we're part of and not separate from the world, when we recognize that we are part of the world, that human beings are not living on the planet, human beings are part of the planet. We are one integrated whole. We are cells on the body of the planet in the same way we each have cells that make up the body of our body that we call our body. And when you have that mystical experience, which many people have talked about in my second book, Psychedelic Wisdom, where I interviewed prominent tribal elders from all over the country about their psychedelic experiences. And what they talked about is this a spiritual experience that you mentioned, Nick, gives them a sense of being part of, being in the flow of nature. And when you're in the flow, when you feel part of everything, there's nothing to be afraid of. You simply are. And that alleviates all fear and anxiety. And that is one of the beauties of the psychedelic experience for many people. This realization that we are part of everything and everything is part of us. And it might sound airy-fairy and it might sound too fuzzy, but when you have the experience, you have the experience and there's nothing like it.
Wonderful. Wonderful. Well, I think that may be a pretty good place to wrap this up. I would love to keep talking, but I've got a lot I have to do today, unfortunately.
Same here. Thank you.
But let me ask you, what are you working on next? Do you have anything special coming up?
Yes, I do. Now that I'm finishing up, I have finished this book, Psychedelic Medicine at the End of Life, which, as I've mentioned to you, will be released to the public on Election Day. And I think that's cute that they did that. I'm in the process of finishing up my last book on psychedelic medicine, because this is a series. Mm-hmm. You see, my first book was called Psychedelic Medicine, The Healing Powers of LSD, MDMA, Ayahuasca, and Psilocybin. And in that book, I brought to the public the greatest scientists in the United States and what they were doing in their research are these medicines. In the second book, I brought prominent elders who had used these very medicines for the last 40 or 50 years, sub rosa, without anybody knowing. And I outed them, and they're now sharing, each of them, 40 or 50 years of experience. In the next book, it's a integral psychedelic psychotherapy. It's a trade book, sort of a book for school, for learning about using psych, for people to use in classes. The fourth book is the one we talked about somewhat today, Psychedelic Medicine at the End of Life. And my last book is coming up soon, and it's called Psychedelic Medicine, Adverse Effects. Because I want, after telling all the wonderful things in four books, all the wonderful potential of these medicines, I want to also do the opposite of what Big Pharma does. Big Pharma hides their adverse effects. They call them side effects. Right. Side effects. You know, the side effect makes it sound like, oh, it's just something that happens on your side. You don't feel it. Well, no, there's no such a thing. An adverse effect affects your whole body. So I'm doing the opposite. I'm telling the public all the adverse effects of all the psychedelics, and that will be my last book in the series, Psychedelic Medicine, Adverse Effects. I look forward to coming back and talking to you about it.
Yes, thank you. I was just going to say, yes, you have to come back and we can chat about that book.
Yes, so, love
to. I would look forward to that. I would look forward to that. Yeah, we have to speak more often. I always enjoy speaking with you, Richard.
Thank you.
Yeah, so, all right. Do you have a website or?
Yes, mindbodyhealthpolitics.org. Mindbodyhealthpolitics.org. And all the archives from my 20 years of broadcasting are on the website, open source, no charge, no fee for the public to hear. Mindbodyhealthpolitics.org.
Okay, wonderful.
You can also follow me on Instagram because I'm giving away free health tips in 90-second bites on Instagram.
All right. What's the Instagram address?
That I don't know.
I'll find it. I'll put.
I think it's Dr. That. Richard Lewis Miller.
Okay. I'll find it and I'll put a link for that in the show notes and video description, as well as for the webpage. And of course, links to your latest book, Psychedelic Medicine and the End of Life.
Yeah, we're on YouTube and Facebook also, Nick.
Okay. All right. Wonderful. Yeah. And when this episode airs, I will connect it to your Instagram and Facebook.
Yes.
And everything.
I'll have Charlie contact you.
Yeah. Yeah. Wonderful. So, all right. Well, Richard, thank you again so much for your time. I really appreciate it and appreciate all the work you do. And it was an absolute delight to reconnect with you.
Thank you. Same here, Nick.
All right.
Well, in regards to Denver, that's where I imported my wife from. She was from Denver.
Yeah. It's an awesome city. I love Colorado.
Take care. Bye-bye. Right,
you too. Goodbye. And that's a wrap on episode 172 of Rebel Spirit Radio. Thank you so much for listening or watching if you're part of my YouTube audience. Now, I think all of you know what's coming up next. No surprises. Sign up for my Patreon. Share this with friends and family and on social media too, please. Subscribe to the podcast or follow it on whatever platform you use to listen to or view podcasts. You do know the drill. But the thing is, all of that is really important. Sharing, subscribing, or following are all free, and they only take a few seconds to do. And they really do help. Right now, putting together this podcast is a labor of love, and I do love it. I'm in the process of making some changes to the podcast and the YouTube channel. It's slow going, but your support will help me speed up the process and ensure that I can continue with the podcast and offer much more content than what I provide now. As I always like to say, I'm here in the front range now doing missionary work in regards to religion, spirituality and ecology, psychedelics and consciousness, and how all of this can help us heal humanity's relationship with the sacred earth. So if you feel moved by the rebel spirit, and you know I sure hope that you do, then please, by all means, help me in my efforts to share the good news. I'm Nick Mather, and you've been listening to, or watching, Rebel Spirit Radio. Until next time, may you be in peace, may you flourish in all possible ways, and may you continue to nurture your rebel spirit.